Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. ESG, or Environmental, Social, Governance, promises to help the bottom line and the planet at the same time. Is it too good to be true? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of an episode digging into that very question.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. A new week brings preparations for a new stage in the House impeachment inquiry. Congress is technically on recess, but House investigators have a full lineup of depositions, including, maybe, ousted former National Security Advisor John Bolton. The whistleblower offers to answer written questions from House Republicans, but remains anonymous, much to the president's deep chagrin. Plus, the Democratic field for 2020 narrows, casualties mount in Syria, and popular protests continue around the world. So this hour On Point, top reporters guide us through another big week in the news. And you can join us. How did the House impeachment inquiry vote last week change your thinking on the proceedings so far? Do you think this week's depositions, if any of them actually happen, will clarify things? Are you ready for the House to open the door on public hearings? Join us anytime on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio or on our website, onpointradio.org as well. Well, joining us now from Washington is Darlene Superville, White House correspondent for the Associated Press. Darlene, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks for having me on.
Also with us from Washington as well is Liz Landers, Washington correspondent for Vice News. Liz, it's good to have you.
Great to be joining. Thanks.
And Nick Schifrin joins us from Arlington, Virginia. Nick is PBS NewsHour foreign affairs and defense correspondent. Nick, it's good to have you back as well.
Thanks very much.
And a little later this hour, we will be hearing from Democratic Congressman Raja Krishnamoorthy of Illinois. But Darlene, let me just first start with you. It looks like the White House, the strategy that they're putting forth is basically no cooperation, no witnesses at all. Is that what we have set for us this week?
Yes, that would appear to be what is on tap for this week. There are a number of witnesses that are scheduled to appear this week, starting today. There are two officials from the National Security Council on tap for today, also two from the Office of Management and Budget. Energy Secretary Rick Perry is expected or was invited to appear later this week. House Democrats also want to talk to John Bolton, who is the former National Security Advisor to President Donald Trump. None of those officials are expected to appear. In fact, Secretary Perry's office said last week that he would not participate in this. John Bolton's attorney has said that he will not appear voluntarily, only under if subpoenaed, if ordered to appear. And the four officials who are on tap today are not expected to appear. And one of those officials is the NSC attorney who some of the officials who have already testified approached with their concerns about the July 25th telephone conversation that President Trump had with the leader of Ukraine. And the White House has already, you know, weeks ago laid out that they will not cooperate with this process, deeming it unfair, saying that the president doesn't have any due process, so on and so forth.
Yeah.
And that is what you will see again this week.
Well, Liz Landers, Darlene pointing out John Eisenberg, that's the White House legal advisor she was talking about, who Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman is said to have testified that Eisenberg told him, just to sort of underscore what Darlene said, not to talk about his concerns about that phone call. He's almost certainly not going to appear as summoned. I mean, what are the implications of that and the complete stonewalling that we see here from the White House?
Right. Well, it completely breaks with precedent. And I think that we keep seeing this over and over in many ways with this White House, but they are refusing to cooperate. And this has not happened before in the past. I mean, even in Nixon and during Clinton years, during those impeachment proceedings, there were tons of documents turned over and chiefs of staff who testified. So, yes, this is a complete stonewalling that this White House has taken. But I will say that when you talk to Democrats on the Hill, they feel like even if these people do not come forward this week, this NSC lawyer, Robert Blair, some of these people who are defying subpoenas, they still feel that their case is being made to the public. There are these opening testimonies that have become public. We saw that from Bill Taylor and also from Vinland as well. And Democrats that I've been talking to on the Hill think, you know, even if these other White House officials and NSC officials refuse to come testify, their case is still being built and they're still gathering the evidence that they think they need to impeach the president.
Mm. Well, Nick Schifrin, we see from House Republicans this continuing assertion or insistence that this has so far been a non-transparent process. I mean, House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy just this morning was on Twitter saying, quote, Democrats voted for an impeachment inquiry that they claimed would provide transparency and due process. But they're right back at it behind closed doors in the basement of the Capitol. Now, I mean, technically, there are Republicans on these committees who can attend all of these depositions. But what do you make of this continuing insistence by House Republicans that the process is not transparent?
Well, I think they've found a couple of arguments that they feel fit and work well with their base, and the president is largely supportive of that or behind some of those messaging. You know, it started as, well, this is only secondhand information. The problem is that Lieutenant Colonel Vindman, as was mentioned before, had firsthand accounts. And they said, well, no pressure was applied on Ukraine, but then they released a partial transcript, and obviously the president did apply a little pressure on Ukraine. Then they said, well, aid was delayed, but not for Biden. And, you know, every step of the way, they've created a message, thrown it against the wall, and it's kind of fallen off until they hit this process argument. And this is the one that has hit most consistently, that this is behind closed doors. Now, what stopped that argument, of course, is the vote to move toward public hearings and to release the transcripts. But here we are on Monday morning, a few days after Democrats voted to go public with this effort, and we still have closed door depositions going on. Democrats say this is still part of the process. There are quite a few people they still want to hear from, not only the people we've mentioned already, but also people close to Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, the counselor at the State Department, and the Undersecretary State for Political Affairs are both scheduled for Wednesday. But Republicans say, hey, look, you're still doing these closed door depositions. This isn't a real process. We deserve to have this in public. And of course, you see the president leading that messaging, which they believe is working.
All right. Now, Democrats seem to be saying that open hearings could begin next week. We'll have to see. But let's just listen to what White House advisor Kellyanne Conway said when she was on Fox News Sunday with Chris Wallace yesterday, talking about whether the White House will cooperate at all with the impeachment inquiry. And here you'll hear Kellyanne Conway talking about whether the president will stop former National Security Advisor John Bolton from testifying.
Well, Ambassador Bolton publicly and his lawyer have said he's not sure he'll appear. That has nothing to do with the president. He's not sure.
But I'm asking you, what is the president telling Bolton?
I'm not sure the president has talked to Ambassador Bolton. But we as a White House will continue to exert executive privilege where we feel that it is necessary.
So the House vote doesn't make any difference.
On that. The House vote doesn't make a difference in terms of a flawed process somehow becoming open and transparent. And they should have done this from the beginning.
Darlene, help us understand, is this Kellyanne Conway just following what Nick was saying, this what they found to be perhaps a successful line of attack here on transparency, or what, you know, what exactly is she saying?
I think it strikes me as a little bit of both, right? You had the transparency argument, everything is going on behind closed doors, and then you have lawmakers leaking in the view of the White House portions of the testimony that amplified their part of the story. The president, I think it was yesterday when he was returning from a weekend in New York City, was asked the question about Bolton and whether he would try to keep him from testifying. And his response was that that
was up to John Bolton and his attorneys. That, of course, remains to be seen because, as Kelly and Conway said in the clip that you just played, the White House is still very much interested in exerting executive privilege wherever they can. And Bolton was obviously a very close advisor to the president, and I could certainly see the president and the White House telling Mr. Bolton, Ambassador Bolton, don't go to the Hill.
Mm. Liz, your thoughts on that?
Well, I think that if Bolton appears before Congress, which, by the way, it sounds like he might. His lawyer has been kind of coy but said that he might appear if he is subpoenaed. Well, it turns out that basically all of these witnesses have been subpoenaed the morning of. I believe today Robert Blair was subpoenaed just this morning as well. He was supposed to be one of the people who is supposed to appear today. So if they do get Bolton in a chair, Bolton is key to all of this, right? I mean, we saw in the Bill Taylor testimony that Bolton's name is sort of littered throughout that. And, you know, he was very close with President Trump. And it seems the way that the White House is reacting to this, that they are nervous and that the president is nervous about what Bolton may reveal to Congress. And it could be beyond this Ukraine call. Remember that. I mean, there are so many calls that Bolton would have been on that he may reveal something to Congress that we don't even know about.
Mm. Well, Nick, we've just got about a minute here before we have to take a break. A couple of days ago, you spoke with Congressman Adam Schiff. What insight did he give you about the next steps that the House might take?
So Adam Schiff told me that he would try and release transcripts for the House Intelligence Committee, which he chairs, would try and release transcripts early this week. And he has since said that to other reporters, and his aides have said the same thing. So they're on the record having to release these transcripts. And just to make a quick point about the transcripts, so as we see them, presumably not in a full release, but presumably in drips and drabs starting over the next couple of days, is that both sides will cherry pick them. Democrats will obviously point to the excerpts that say that the president put pressure on new president of Ukraine, Volodymyr Zelensky. But Republicans will cite examples where they feel like the president did nothing wrong. And these transcripts will be hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of pages. And so we'll have to sift through them. And that'll take quite a while.
Well, Nick Schifrin, Liz Landers, and Darlene Superville, stand by here for a second. We're talking about what to expect in yet another big week in the news. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken? A podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. A recent episode featured a debate about ESG, or environmental social governance.
This sounds like more work than just putting your money into a social impact fund.
It's a lot more work.
Yeah.
Anybody who thinks there's an easy solution here is either engaged in puffery, greenwash, or deceiving themselves.
Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the episode.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour with a roundtable of top reporters about what to expect in what is certain to be yet another big week in the news. I'm joined today by Darlene Superville. She's White House correspondent for the Associated Press. Liz Landers is with us. She's Washington correspondent for Vice News. And Nick Schifrin also joins us. He's foreign affairs and defense correspondent for PBS NewsHour. And now I'd like to welcome into the conversation Representative Raja Krishnamoorthy. He's a Democrat from Illinois, and he's a member of the House Intelligence Committee as well, joining us today from Washington. Congressman, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Meghna.
So first of all, let's just pick up where Nick Schifrin left us off before the break here, because maybe you can provide us a more up-to-date answer. When do you expect the House Intelligence Committee to release transcripts from depositions that you've already taken?
Well, I think that Chairman Schiff had told various folks in the media that he planned to do it this week, so I expect that to happen. As you know, there are a lot of witnesses that actually came forward, to our surprise, defying White House orders not to cooperate, and gave extensive testimony, sometimes upwards of 10, 11 hours of testimony. So I think that the staff will have to go through and redact, you know, for sensitive or other information that should not be publicly released. But otherwise, I expect maximum transparency as to these transcripts very shortly.
Do you feel, and does the committee feel, a sense of urgency around this? Because, as you well know, Republican members of the House and the administration as well have been consistently saying that they believe this whole process has not been transparent.
I think that has been a really bogus argument. I'll just tell you what's happened in these closed proceedings. You know, more than 40 Republicans have actually been able to participate. They've been able to question witnesses for the same amount of time that Democrats have, and they've been able to question them as to any topic that they want, and they've been able to offer opening statements. They've taken advantage of all those things. So to say that that's unfair is really unfounded, but all that being said, Chairman Schiff wants to bring maximum transparency to these proceedings. We took a vote that allows for the transcripts to be released, mm-hmm. and so that's what's going to happen this week.
So you can't yet say if it'll be Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, not sure?
I think it's more of a logistical thing mm-hmm. right now than anything else.
And then do you have any further information about when we might see the beginning of public hearings?
I don't have a date, Meghna. I think that Speaker Pelosi has made it clear that it's going to happen in short order. Again, I think that it's a matter of logistics and the calendar and making sure that witnesses are available on certain days more than anything else. But I just want to say the people that, you know, hopefully will appear for these public proceedings, the same ones that we questioned in the SCIF, the underground bunker beneath the Capitol, are, you know, members of the administration. They are career public servants, apolitical, and I would say they're really to be commended because they came forward sticking their necks on the line, their careers on the line, coming at expense to themselves, hiring their own attorneys to tell the truth. And I think that people will be very impressed with the caliber of witnesses that they see publicly.
So, Congressman, based on what you've heard so far, and the public has already seen at least some of the opening statements from some of these witnesses, Lieutenant Colonel Vindman, Bill Taylor as well, do you believe the House has a case so far or already for impeachment?
So I want to withhold judgment on the ultimate question of impeachment because I want to wait for all the evidence to come in, and we still yet to see everyone in public as well. That being said, there's mounting evidence of serious misconduct that took place surrounding the July 25th phone call from President Trump to President Zelensky, and there are at least two serious episodes of misconduct here. One, merely requesting foreign assistance with domestic election efforts is illegal in and of itself. But on top of that, to use security assistance to the Ukraine as well as the prospect of a White House meeting to pressure them, adds to the misconduct. And I think there's evidence of all of the above, and that's extremely disturbing at this point.
Mm. Well, actually, Congressman, let me just take a quick call here. Let me go to Mark, who's calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Mark, you're on the air.
Hi, Magna. I love your show. I want to know why hasn't the House, with the people who have not responded to the subpoenas, why hasn't the House indicted them and either jailed them or fined them or else filed an obstruction of justice against the White House? It seems like Trump's people can flaunt the rule of law and get away with it.
Right. Mark, thank you for your call. This question keeps coming up again and again. So, Congressman Krishnamoorthy, do you have a response for Mark?
Sure, and thank you for the question. You know, anybody who is not complying with a subpoena is basically going to be figuring into charges of potential obstruction of the inquiry. And any evidence that's withheld, whether it's testimony or documents, would be considered corroborative of the underlying complaint, especially by the whistleblower. But now we've seen a number of other claims come forward, too. There are other remedies as well, but what's interesting to me, Meghna, among other things, is that I think those particular, the treatment of these witnesses and others who don't comply with subpoenas, I think has really encouraged a lot of others to come forward. So that's I think, very interesting to me.
What's the one question that you want the answer to more than anything?
I think that we've seen a lot of evidence with regard to the security assistance to the Ukraine, as well as the White House meeting being withheld for purposes of, you know, investigating the president's political operatives, political initiatives. And I think that I want to hear from more people about what they saw, heard, and who directed these particular episodes. I want to see more evidence of that, because we need to fully flesh it out and hold everyone accountable who may have participated in the misconduct. We can't end this by just holding one or two people accountable if the misconduct actually occurred, and then others to go off scot-free. That would be really bad, because we would, you know, send the wrong message to those who actually participated that they can get away with it. And then from a very practical standpoint, we can't allow them to continue with that misconduct going forward. So we need to know the full outlines of what's happened.
Well, Congressman Raja Krishnamoorthy, Democrat from Illinois, member of the House Intelligence Committee. Congressman, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Meghna.
Darlene Superville, White House correspondent for the Associated Press. Anything that you heard the congressman say that sort of makes you wonder about what might happen this week or in the coming weeks?
I think a key thing for this week will be when the transcripts start coming out. And, you know, Nick was talking about that earlier. Mm-hmm. It's going to be volumes and volumes of pages, and you're going to see both sides, the Republicans and Democrats, try to cherry pick and you know, use whatever they find to their advantage. And it's going to take reporters like us three and all of our colleagues hours and hours to sift through all of those pages. Remember, many of these depositions lasted 9 hours, 10 hours. So it's going to be a lot of paper to go through. And then also, once the transcripts do come out, the reaction from the White House and from the president himself to, you know, what we see these witnesses said.
Right. So Liz Landers, speaking of the president, I mean, he's been focused a lot on the whistleblower, right? I mean, he's sort of yes. taken his Twitter shots at other people who have testified so far. But there's this unrelenting focus on the whistleblower, whose attorney says that now the whistleblower will offer to answer written questions. But that's not good enough for the president. I mean, he just tweeted today that he believes the whistleblower ought to be compelled to testify.
He seems completely consumed with this right now. And you're right. He's been tweeting about it. He tweeted about it, you know, probably 10 times this past weekend. He's been answering questions about it as he's coming to and from New York. And there was a reporter yesterday who even asked the president if he was thinking about naming the whistleblower and revealing that person's identity, which is supposed to be protected, of course. That is the point of being a whistleblower. You have protection to remain anonymous. And the president did not say no when he was asked that question, which that really stuck out to me. And I think that you see Republicans right now who are also very hung up on this idea of the whistleblower as well, and who that person's identity is and whether they have political leanings and affiliations. I think that there are some claims that have been made, I think they are unfounded at this point, that the whistleblower has political ties to a candidate. But this is clearly, I think, we're going to keep seeing mm-hmm. this as part of the messaging for this next phase when this becomes a public impeachment inquiry and it's not behind closed doors. I think we're going to see this a lot from Republicans.
Well, in fact, the president said very recently that he's even calling on members of the media, reporters, to name the whistleblower. He believes some members of the Washington media do know who it is. Here is the president just yesterday on the South Lawn at the White House.
They think they know. They know who it is. You know who it is. You just don't want to report it. CNN knows who it is, but you don't want to report it. And you know, you'd be doing the public a service if you did. The whistleblower gave a false report.
Nick Schifrin, first of all, it seems as if much of what we've already heard from or know of testimony that's been given actually supports or verifies the whistleblower's report. Just wanted to point that out. But in normal times, even someone calling for a whistleblower's identity to be revealed, I mean, I've seen critics of the president say that just in and of itself, that ought to be an impeachable offense. But the president just said it. I mean, what do you think about his focus here on the whistleblower?
Magna, if these were normal times, we'd be talking about different things every day for the last couple of years, I'd say. So look, there are a lot of reports, as Liz suggested, of the whistleblower's name. And we do know a few details about this person. And yes, a lot of media members are not reporting those details because, as Liz suggested, it is federal law that protects this whistleblower's identity. Now, that said, of course, the fact that some conservative media outlets are printing a person's name means that we've all asked this person's lawyers, and the lawyers simply refuse to confirm or deny. So, you know, that's where we are in terms of the whistleblower's identity at this point. But the president will continue to make the argument, and I think that depending on which details of the whistleblower come out, the argument will be associated based on the timing of this person's appointments to the agencies that this person has worked. And that will be somehow a sign of political leaning. And of course, what historically, if you call it in normal times, we have believed is that this person's in the intelligence community. You know, intelligence officials, whether they are appointed under a Democratic president or Republican president, does not matter. They serve the higher purpose, if you will, of analyzing intelligence. And so that argument has largely been lost and probably will continue to be lost, given that Republicans on the three committees that are questioning witnesses right now demand a lot more, as we've been saying, than just the written statements that the whistleblower's attorneys vow or are offering to provide. They are calling for some kind of public testimony, even though, as you point out, Magna, that the whistleblower did not have firsthand knowledge of the phone call. And we have now heard from half a dozen, at least, officials behind closed doors who have had mm-hmm. firsthand knowledge, who have corroborated much of what the whistleblower believed that had happened.
Well, let's go back to our callers. Let's go to Aaron, who's calling from Omaha, Nebraska. Aaron, you're on the air.
Hi, Magna. My question, I guess, is sort of along the lines of what you guys were just talking about. My mind is still trying to bring everything back into the normal times. and it is, I can't quite understand what the, I guess, legal or even rational sort of justification there is for wanting to see who the whistleblower is, especially given the fact, as you guys have stated, that we have so many witnesses, firsthand witnesses, who have corroborated what the whistleblower brought out. So how is it that the Republicans and the president himself and the president's supporters, what justification are they trying to give other than kind of a witch hunt and wanting to get at his political enemies? Outside of that, is there any good reason for us needing to know who the whistleblower is?
Right. Well, Aaron, thank you so much for your call. And Darlene, let me turn back to you on this because just, you know, as Nick said, there's federal law protecting whistleblowers. So there's really no legal justification. But I think Nick was getting to this where when you said, really, it's a political question. And ultimately, you know, in the biggest picture, So is impeachment. It's a political question. So this is we're seeing, you know, the continuation of a strategy here from the president and from the White House, Darlene.
Right. And I thank the caller for the question. I would just say that we have seen this playbook before. Right. This is an attempt by President Trump and his Republican allies in Congress to basically try to discredit the whistleblower. Every day when the president gives a speech, he does a rally, he talks to reporters going and coming from the White House. His comment is always that he had a perfect call with Ukraine's leader. He did nothing wrong. The whistleblower got it wrong. It's an attempt. It's another attempt to sort of discredit the witness. And we saw this for the past 2 years during the Russia investigation that was led by Special Counsel Robert Mueller. There was a daily attempt by the president through tweets and public comments to undermine that investigation. And I think that's the same thing that we're seeing right here. Of course, the point has been made, excuse me, that at this point, the whistleblower does seem irrelevant because mm-hmm. we have had testimony from so many people who actually listened in on the call. The whistleblower said that he had secondhand information. He was not on the call. We have had a few people testify who were on the call. So it would seem to make the whistleblower a little bit irrelevant. But nevertheless, it is just another attempt by the White House, the president, and his allies in Congress to discredit this individual.
Right. And Darlene, as you said, it's an age-old device used by defense attorneys in virtually every case to discredit a witness.
Exactly.
When we will come back, we'll talk about what's happening on the Senate side of things regarding the views on the impeachment inquiry and also the effect all of this is having on the 2020 presidential race. We'll briefly touch down on a little bit of international news as well. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
Hi, On Point listeners. I'm poet and author Shinyi Pai. As you celebrate Asian American Pacific Islander Heritage Month, I invite you to listen to the 10,000 Things podcast from KUOW and the NPR Network. 10,000 Things is a podcast about modern artifacts of Asian American life, ordinary objects that tell extraordinary stories and reveal something profound about the experience of being Asian in America. Find 10,000 Things from KUOW and the NPR Network, wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking with a roundtable of top reporters today about what's going to be another big week in the news. We already know that several people who have been subpoenaed to provide depositions to the House impeachment inquiry investigation are likely not going to show up. That's just one of the many big stories. Also, what effect is all of this having on the 2020 presidential race? We're joined today by Darlene Superville. She is White House correspondent for the Associated Press. Liz Landers is with us. She's White House correspondent for Vice News. And Nick Schifrin also joins us. He's foreign affairs and defense correspondent for PBS NewsHour. Now, everyone, I just wanted to get your quick takes on how Senate Republicans are sort of crafting their messaging in this moment now, because I think we're seeing a move towards perhaps acknowledging that some kind of conversation, some kind of quid pro quo may have happened between President Donald Trump and the Ukrainian president, but that Senate Republicans are saying it's not necessarily wrong to do that. I mean, here's House Minority Whip Steve Scalise, Republican from Louisiana, of course, on the House side here. So not the Senate. Forgive me, on the House side. He was on with George Stephanopoulos, host of ABC's This Week, talking about the appropriateness of the president's interactions here. And Scalise, here's Scalise responding to Stephanopoulos's multiple attempts to ask whether or not it was right for the president to do what he did.
That wasn't, first of all, about political opponents. The law, George, requires President Trump or any president, when they're sending foreign aid, taxpayer money to another country, to first ensure that that country is rooting out corruption. He and Zelensky were talking about that on the phone call. That's a law, by the way, that most Democrats voted for.
The only two instances he raised were CrowdStrike in 2016 involving the Democrats, Burisma in 2017 and 18 involving Joe Biden. Again, it's just a very simple question. Do you think it's appropriate for the president to ask the Ukrainians or the Chinese, which he's also done in public, to investigate his domestic political opponents?
And the interview actually goes on, and Stephanopoulos asks Scalise a couple more times about the appropriateness, and Congressman Scalise continued to deny that the Ukraine call was about the president's political opponents at all. So, Liz Landers, what do you see here in what GOP members are saying?
I have experienced a contrast between what the House Republicans are saying and what the Senate Republicans are saying. I think House members that I speak with are going along the lines of what you heard from Scalise there, saying there was absolutely no quid pro quo. The president didn't do anything wrong, and basically saying that there's no there there. When you talk with members of the Senate, and I thought that this was so interesting from Lindsey Graham about 2 weeks ago. Graham is one of President Trump's biggest defenders on the Hill. He held a press conference about the House's handling of the impeachment inquiry. And Graham said, look, the president isn't perfect. And I think that there are members of the Republican Party in the Senate who acknowledge that they would not have had that kind of phone call and conducted themselves that way on a call with Ukraine, but do not think that it's an impeachable offense. And I think that, you know, with the Senate coming as the jury in this impeachment process, that they are trying to right now sort of, you know, stay a little bit of an arm's distance away from this. I don't think that a lot of Senate Republicans want to comment on this, and they are talking about the process as why they don't want to comment on it. But I do think that they are more willing to say, yes, this is not something I would have done, but it's not impeachable.
Right. Well, let's go to Greg, who's got a question about exactly this, calling from Omaha, Nebraska. Greg, you're on the air.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. Yeah, I think this isn't an impeachable offense, but my take out of the whole thing is the Republicans, and I can't remember the two Democrats, but I know they're in a heavy Republican area where they're from, and they voted against it. And my take is they're trying to appease their base because their base is against it, the impeachment. And I think they're just looking at votes. And my take is if they do that, the Democrats need to bring this up. I don't care what the Republicans do. They need to go forward with this because if they don't, then, I mean, why have a government?
Mm-hmm. Well, Greg, thank you for your call. Nick, you want to respond to Greg?
Yeah, so Greg's talking about Colin Peterson and Jeff Van Drew, the two Democrats, and he's right, from Republican-leaning districts who broke with their party and voted against against the Thursday vote to proceed toward public hearings. I let me just make two points. I mean, we are all looking at this through both a legal and political lens, but it's clear from the Constitution that this is a political question, you know, and go back to your question to the congressman about what happens when people do not show up. The response was, well, this will be part of our obstruction case. So this is not a question of criminality or legal question, that this is a real political question. And then secondly, you know, it's just not clear right now what message is going to stick. I think that, as we've been talking about before, the messaging from the Republicans and the president have been multiple, all the way from, you know, the whistleblower only has secondhand information to criticisms of the process. And now we get to a phase which is what Liz was referring to, which is, look, this call might have been problematic, but it's not an impeachable offense, which is what the caller just said. And so that is the message that is seems probably going to take hold over the next couple of weeks. But as we talked about before, the Democrats still have, or the Intelligence Committee is still leading these closed-door depositions. And so the argument that this is still closed-door will remain at least for another week. So I think that, you know, all of these messages will continue to go on, but we do have to remember that ultimately this is a political decision. It is a political vote. And what we expect is if the House does vote for impeachment, mostly, if not all, along party lines, the Senate is likely not to convict the president again along party lines, which just reinforces that this is a political question, not a criminal one.
Right. Well, let's go to Philip, who's calling from Westfield, Wisconsin. Philip, you're on the air.
Hi. I just got a comment I'd like to make. You know, if you're National Public Radio, I don't understand why this thing is so skewed in one direction. All your comments and all your guests that you have on, and you know, I used to love your programming. I got to tell you something. This is getting old, real old for me.
Well,
it's like a nonstop attack on the President of the United States. There's things that he says that I don't really care for either, but I'm going to tell you something. I really think you're doing yourself a disservice. It's National Public Radio. If you guys are only going to have guests on that look at one side of this thing, what about all the good he's done?
Well, Philip, hang on here for a second. So I just want to say that we have three reporters here who aren't taking a side. They're simply reporting the facts as we know them so far in the impeachment inquiry and what members of Congress have told them. They're doing their jobs as reporters. But like, what are you saying here? I mean, do you not want to hear about the details of the impeachment inquiry anymore? And if not, why not?
You're saying facts as we know them. You're saying facts as they're being reported, and you're not getting you're only putting on air one side of this thing.
What is the?
I don't get it.
But what would be the other side? I mean, we regularly request Republican members of Congress to join us on the show all the time. I can't compel them to come on the air. I really wish they would.
Well, I really think you're doing the country a disservice, to tell you the truth.
I just don't understand how. Can you tell me how? What is the disservice when we're talking about an inquiry happening in a co-equal branch of government into the actions? It's an inquiry. There's no impeachment yet. What's the disservice in following what our elected representatives are doing?
And I got a news for you. I don't think there's going to be an impeachment. I don't think they'll ever get this through the Senate. I think Nancy Pelosi bit off more than she can chew.
Well, Philip, thank you so much for your call, and actually really appreciate you sticking with us and listening. Darlene Superville, I got to wonder. I mean, Philip is not alone in his frustration. Obviously, I take issue with his particular criticism here. But, what's your sense as to how the ongoing inquiry is playing, you know, amongst the American people, amongst voters?
That's an interesting question. I can't say that I've seen any polling that would speak to that, but my sense is that it's probably 50-50. I mean, you will have a certain segment of the population that is very interested in what's happening. After all, this will only be the fourth time that a president of the United States is facing being impeached by the House. I would correct one thing that Philip said. He seemed to suggest that impeachment is a function of the Senate, where the impeachment, it's the House that would vote to impeach the president. And then if that happens, then you would have a trial in the Senate. and the Senate senators would serve as jurors, and they would have to vote to either acquit or convict the president. If he is acquitted, he remains in office. If he is convicted, he would be removed from office, something that has never been done before in this country. And just on that basis alone, this is a major piece of history playing out in Washington, and we would all be remiss if we didn't talk about it.
Well, about polling, the president is expressing some frustration around polling because, according to a Fox News poll, 49% of Americans want President Trump removed from office. That's from a Fox News poll. And the president really criticized polling yesterday, speaking once again from the South Lawn of the White House.
I have the real polls. The CNN polls are fake. The Fox polls have always been lousy. I tell them they ought to get themselves a new pollster. But the real polls, if you look at the polls, you look at the polls that came out this morning, people don't want anything to do with impeachment.
So that's the president responding to some recent polling about the impeachment inquiry. Liz Landers, let's turn the focus a minute to Democrats running for the White House here. If you're Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren, who might be compelled to spend a lot of time in Washington if this moves eventually to the Senate, do you kind of not? I mean, how do you feel about the process as it continues to move forward?
Well, I think that this is a very important point to make, Meghna, is that there are, you know, what, six senators who are running for president right now, and those people are all compelled by law to show up for their day jobs if the House does vote to impeach the president and this moves to the Senate for a trial. So this will have a huge, huge effect on the Democratic primary process, I think, if this moves in that direction, because all of a sudden you have a Bernie Sanders and an Elizabeth Warren who are top of the pack right now. They're in the top tiers of this Democratic primary process, and they will not be allowed to be on the campaign trail. Right now, if you look at how many votes some of these senators who are running for president, how many votes that they have missed, some of them have missed about 100 votes so far in the Senate this fall. They will not be able to skip any of these days where there will be a trial. So I think that this is something that the Democrats in the House, and especially Speaker Pelosi, have to be thinking about, is how will our process and how long this process takes in the House affect our own Democratic presidential process?
Well, let's see if we can fit one more call in here. John's calling from Brockton, Massachusetts. John, you're on the air.
Yes, thanks for taking my call. I mean, I listened to this last caller about how unfair you are, and I have the opposite take. I think Trump has got the media cowed into repeating these absurd narratives that he's putting forth, like that the whistleblower is some extremely relevant person when he's at this point totally irrelevant. Mm. And these ideas that the process is unfair and a witch hunt. The Trump has, by calling y'all the fake media, has you all cowed into repeating these idiotic denials.
Yeah. Well, John, so, I'm going to just take it back from you because we have just 2 minutes left here. And thank you for your call. Nick Schifrin, apparently we can please nobody. That's okay. I think that means that we're doing it right here. But we, in the last minute that we had, I'm just going to set aside domestic politics. I do want to lean on your expertise as the foreign affairs correspondent for PBS NewsHour. There's a whole other world of news out there, Nick. So just give us what your take is on this continuation of worldwide protests in multiple countries around the world.
Yeah, and I'll try and do this in 30 seconds so I can segue.
Into
the substantive questions from our last two callers. So Middle East and Latin America are the two places that I think we all, as people who care about what's happening in the world, should focus on. Iraq, the prime minister is about to fall. Lebanon, the prime minister has fallen. Young protesters in the streets calling for sweeping changes to political systems. They're talking about corruption. They're talking about unemployment. They're talking about about bad public services. And these are not the typical sectarian protests that we have seen there in the past. This is kind of a post-sectarian, much more generational, fundamental shift on the streets in the Middle East, in Latin America. Places like Chile, the region's most stable country by far, protests that we haven't seen certainly in democratic Chile's history over the last few decades. These are things that we can be talking about. And let me just bring up one last one. China, which is the president is trying to make a sign of preliminary deal with Xi Jinping. We don't talk about this enough. There is so much going on in D.C. What the president says is newsworthy. There are policies that President Trump is pursuing that we're not focusing on, and some that he receives bipartisan support for, including China. Last two points. Republicans don't come on these shows very often. They don't believe that it helps them. And that leads to the last one, the reduced importance of the news. President Trump and other Republicans believe that they are reaching the public without us, and that trend will only continue.
Well, Nick Schifrin with PBS NewsHour, Liz Landers with Vice, and Darlene Superville with the Associated Press, thank you all for doing the jobs that you do and for joining us today. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes.
Can profit motive save the planet? Is a company that takes the climate into account a better investment? How about one that pays workers a living wage and champions transparency and board diversity? That's the idea of ESG, or environmental social governance.
Sounds like a wonderful story. You can make more money, you can save the planet at the same time. Almost no one is going to turn that down.
It's a story that Andy King of Questrom and Veet Henish of the Wharton School challenged during a recent event at Questrom. Professor King played the critic, who says these are problems for regulation to solve, not markets.
As a famous economist said to me, you can't fix externalities with the profit motive, because the profit motive is not linked to externalities. Externalities are the byproduct of pursuing profits. So you can't fix them by getting people to even look harder at profits.
Meanwhile, Veet emphasized that ESG can be an important part of the solution.
Regulation matters, and we need better regulation. And we need to reallocate trillions of dollars of capital over time to the climate transition alone, forgetting social justice, racial justice, and other ESG issues. We're going to need the profit motive for that. No government regulation is going to reallocate tens of trillions of dollars of capital alone. It's going to be investors who are looking at current government regulation and future government regulation and trying to connect the dots.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.